There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to our podcast,
Life After the Letters. I'm Amelie.
And I'm Suba.
We're friends that met whilst working our first shifts as junior doctors.
And we're here to talk about the stories and challenges that we face every day.
This is a reunion of sorts. Amelie and I met Jamie during our first year as doctors. He's a PA and has been for the best part of the last year. Before I continue, can I just say that Jamie was known affectionately by all of the F1s as that really good PA. Essentially the king of PAs. But before becoming a physician's associate, Jamie worked as a senior radiographer at the cath labs for about 4 years. He has a Bachelor of Science in Diagnostic Radiography, Master's in Physician's Associate Studies. He's currently working in malignant hematology at Guy's Hospital alongside the inpatient ward team. So,
hello everyone.
Hello team.
So hey Jamie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so it's so exciting to have Jamie here with us today. So Suba and I, we put out a thing on our Instagrams to say what sort of topics should we bring up, and then Jamie replied saying you need to talk about physician associates. And then as soon as he said that, actually a lot of my doctor friends started chiming into my inbox, and actually a lot of misconceptions about what physician's associates are even came up then. And the difference that I saw between those who knew about, who worked with physician associates versus those who never worked with them, the difference in thought was astounding. But we've talked about that, haven't we, Jamie,
on our way here? Just a little bit.
So, Jamie, do you mind just starting and telling us why you decided to become a physician's associate in the first place and what your journey looked like?
Yeah, sure. So I was working as a radiographer in the cath labs for about 3 or 4 years, and one of my cardiology registrars suggested to me, oh, perhaps you would want to go to medical school or think about going into medicine. And it's something I toyed with for a few years but never really had much of an interest in. So I started looking around. Didn't really feel that I wanted to go to medical school for another 5 years, do F1, F2 working jobs that I didn't want to work in necessarily.
And jobs that you kind of already done.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know. So then someone said, oh, have you heard about this physician assistant, as it was called when I was about to apply? And I was like, no, these people just write discharge letters and that's not really something I want to do the rest of my life. Mm. And I kind of worked around and they said, actually, this job actually is expanding quite well. And so on a whim, I went and met a PA for a day, saw what they did. They worked alongside the juniors.
Mm. Where was that PA?
They were working in London. At this time, they were all working in London. There was nothing really outside of London. Birmingham, Aberdeen, but other than that, nothing else.
Oh, Aberdeen, okay.
Yeah, so they've been running a program for a while.
You know, when you're like, I'm going to miss that train fare. That's not happening.
Literally. So yeah, I met up with them and just chatted to them online, met up with them at work, saw what they did and was like, okay, I can get on board with this. So I applied to a program out in Essex, and it was the first time they're running the PA program. I was really happy that I was successful in the program, and I started there in 2015.
Yeah. So you were living in Essex at the time and working in Essex?
Yep, I was working in Essex in a hospital as a radiographer.
Oh, the same hospital?
Same hospital.
Did you not know this?
Of course I did, because Jamie, when you had Jamie around, you used to get all your scans done ASAP.
Mate, having Jamie around was like a fast track ticket at Thorpe Park. You'd walk in with Jamie on your arm and literally doors are opening, things are just getting done.
People are smiling.
Yeah, you're like, jobs are all done by about 9:15, all right.
Home time. So yeah, it was quite handy actually, because I knew the hospital setting, I knew everything, like where everything was, where the lab was, the lab staff, the imaging staff, so that was quite handy.
And that's all the rubbish that you just need to know straight away to even be successful in your job or to get your job done quickly. Can I ask, and bring it right back to before you became a radiographer, what led you into that field in the first place? What were you thinking when you were in school about what you wanted to be when you grow up?
So, I mean, I was studying A-level biology, chemistry, German and psychology, bit of a random combination. I quite like German, and actually I was wanting to get out and study German at school and be a translator.
Can we throw in, by the way, that Jamie is fully fluent in German?
Are you?
A new ambition.
Hey!
Just a little bit.
Guten Tag.
Yeah, that's good.
Yes.
Das hast du Geburtstag.
What's that?
When is your birthday?
All I can say.
Well done.
Said it in the most like...
I just had to put it in there.
Not a when's your birthday kind of tone of voice.
I literally just random in there. Good, good, good. At least I understood you. That's
thank you.
And
Danke.
My parents and my friends were kind of like, what are you going to do with German? Like, it's not really a career. And I applied for some work experience and basically got put into a hospital for a week and stumbled across a radiographer and I was like, oh, this looks like an interesting job. I was on the radiotherapy side actually to begin with, and I spent one day with a diagnostic radiographer, so x-ray, CT scans, MRIs, and I was like, yeah, this is like a really cool job. It's physics, which I quite enjoy, it's patient care, it's like x-rays, which are cool pictures. This is what I want to do.
And you were telling me that there was obviously the diagnostic course and then the therapeutic course.
Yeah.
Well, so how come you went into a diagnostic at that age?
So for me, I think it was the trauma aspect of it. So the radiotherapy radiographers, they obviously treat cancer with radiotherapy. They do planning CTs for cancer treatment. Mm. And I quite enjoy, and diagnostic radiographers, they tend to work out of A&E, trauma, theatre, resource calls, that kind of thing. And I quite like the buzz of the adrenaline of,
you wanted to be on a TV show, basically.
Basically. I wanted to be on St. George's, you know, and just be up there in 24 hours in A&E taking that vital CT scan. So yeah, I picked that route.
Sweet. And then, so that took you through university. And did you feel like this is what you wanted to do? Or when did questions start popping into your head about?
So I think about 6 months after I qualified, obviously general radiographers, we were in the main department, we're rotating around trauma theatre, you know, x-rays, resus cores, and I kind of thought this is good, but I want something more. And then a cath lab job came up as a permanent radiographer in the cath labs, and I spent some time as a student there. Didn't really know much about what the radiographers did other than, you know, control the machine. And so I went over for a week and just saw there was so much more involved with the team, that, you know, you had to be part of the nursing staff, part of the physiology staff, the consultants relied on you to get good images. And actually, you're more hands-on. And that's when I was like, okay, these radiographers do more. They're involved in the cardiac arrest management. They have to know how to rhythm recognize on ECGs. And that's something I was like, that's really interesting. I want to do that.
So that's the point at which you mentioned you were speaking to one of your registrars, who I think sounds like he noticed that interest you were taking.
Yeah. So they would like get me to hang out on call with them. If we were on call, they'd come in, do the ward rounds with us, like see what's going on. Did that for about 6 months. And that's when they were like, have you thought about medical school?
Because it sounds like in your role as a sort of radiographer in the cath labs, obviously you can make it as strict or as flexible as you want to at the end of the day. I think that's true of any job role. Mm. And it sounds like you had a very sort of open approach to it, where you were sort of like, even when you're talking about it, saying how there's so many aspects to the job that if you're interested in, you can dive into.
Yeah, and my manager was really supportive. She was like, okay, you want to, you know, learn to scrub up and be a scrub nurse? Let's go. And the nursing staff are like, yeah, we need more people to help out.
Yeah.
The consultants are like, okay, you want to be involved with like rhythm recognition? The physiologist are like, yeah, we'll teach you. This is how you do an ECG. This is how you interpret it. These are the basic rhythms. And they're really supportive. And I was like, this is really cool. This is what I want to do.
And it's interesting you say that, actually, because there is definitely like a gap for people to cross specialize. Absolutely. And actually, when Subra and I, even though we were laughing about the fact that you could take you into the x-ray department and get our scans done ASAP, actually to have someone who can like traverse different areas is very important in a hospital.
Yeah.
And actually it just makes things a lot more efficient and effective. And I'm sure we'll talk about like the continuity of care that physicians associates provide, but it's great for the service essentially.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think also touching on continuity of care, I know we'll come back to talk about it, but whilst we're on the topic, whilst a lot of us doctors will be rotating every 4 months, it's sometimes that can be a bit detrimental to building all your relationships in the hospital. And that's 90% of your job, isn't it? It's human relationships and having connections with people and being able to rock up and someone be like, oh yeah, it's you from this department. And, you know, and that they rely, they can trust on.
Yeah, and it's a familiar face. They know what they're getting from you. If you say it's urgent, it means urgent. If
exactly.
You say it can be done tomorrow, they know it can wait till tomorrow.
Exactly.
So, and then they get to trust you.
So much of that is reliant on your relationships. And obviously if you're moving every 4 months, you make them and you break them and you just keep on rolling. But let's come back to talking about the whole med school dilemma, because I remember we spoke about this when a physician's associate student and
I was still on the Naren.
Yeah, and I remember talking to you because you had so much interest in like in medicine, and you know, it was so transparent and you were so keen and so eager to learn, and like my favorite student today. And it was just so like encouraged, like so nice, and it was just so easy to be like, oh, have you thought about med school?
Yeah,
and like, have you thought about being a doctor?
I think every PA has thought about medical school at some point, and you have to weigh up the pros and cons. And for me, medical school is going to be probably 5 years. If I could get into a graduate program, another 4 years of, you know, medical training. It's, you know,
the
changing in funding now as well, which is a problem. And then you have to complete F1, F2. And I realize I'm not the kind of person that would want to do a job that I didn't have my heart in 4 months. Obviously, you would do your best because, you know, you've got patients there, but I wouldn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
And the thought of being, you know, not enjoying a job for 2 years did not appeal to me. Whereas the PA, you can apply to any speciality you want to work in directly from graduation.
And you don't get that luxury in medicine, even, I would say, almost depending on your specialty, but sometimes even 4-5 years down the line after you graduate, mm-hmm. Which, yeah, sucks sometimes if you're really clear on what you want to do. Okay, so then let's talk about being a physician's, like, you know, starting your studies as a physician's associate, because also I feel like Jamie's not touched on this, but I, and I don't know if I'm mistaken, but I feel like you're a big, like a kingpin in like,
I wouldn't say that.
I mean, in like even the setup of the studies, because I feel like they were consulting you a lot on sort of feedback on how to.
So I was trying to be quite proactive in the PA role, because at the time when I first started, there was a lot of like negativity around the role.
It still is, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a massive problem at the moment with negativity, especially when the name changed from physician assistant to physician associate. There's lots of problems around that, and you know, there's lots of question, why are we doing this?
There's a lot of confusion around what the roles are, and a lot of people who've not worked with them are like, well, what do they contribute?
Yeah, because the physician assistant role still is around, and you probably guys have probably worked with them before.
So can you tell us what the negativity is about?
So the name change was that you're moving from physician assistant to physician associate, and you're trying to make yourself more independent, and you're trying to make yourself more like a medical practitioner who doesn't need to be with a doctor. And the whole idea of the PA role is that you work in direct consultation with the consultant. You're supervised by them and you have direct access to the consultant for questioning and problems. And a lot of doctors felt that when you changed the name, that we were trying to move away from that structure and that we were trying to be independent and we're trying to be on our own and be, you know, kind of like...
These rogue doctors.
Yeah, literally, literally. People were very concerned about that. And, you know, rightly so. You know, and probably the publicity wasn't out there yet.
Mm.
When I first joined Instagram and Twitter, there was hardly anyone... Yeah. Out there on social media that was PA publicizing. There's a few little, you know, things, but nothing major. And so I just tried to put out the message of, this is what I'm doing, this is my training pathway, this is what I do, and this, more importantly, this is what I don't do currently, and this is why I don't do it.
Should we clarify,
can I ask a question very quickly? So America obviously brought out PAs initially, so that was in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And then the
what
UK...
yeah,
the 1960s.
And I'm really pretty impressed that you know that.
Yeah.
Even all the PAs don't know that.
And I'll tell you why I know it in a little bit. But basically, the role came out in America in the 60s. And then it started developing in the UK, like in the late 90s, early 2000s. That's when you had a big influx of PAs. I think in like 2012, there must have been like, I can't even remember how many. I think there was only 5 training programs.
There was
the time.
5, then it dropped to 3.
Yeah.
And then it dropped back up to 5. And
yeah, so... What was I going to say? So was there a lot of learning from America on the role, and were they quite open about what they did?
So the physician assistants, actually about 2003, some GP practices started realizing they were struggling to recruit permanent staff, and they some of the GPs had gone to America and had worked with PAs and was like, actually these people could really like bolster our team.
Mm.
And brought some American PAs to the UK. And
so how would they work within the general practice system?
So, I mean, they start off with extended consultation time, so usually around 20 minutes or so, because they need to get used to consulting, I think similar to what FYs and GP practice would do. And then they would you know, depending on the practice and the experience of the PA, they would see a varied workload from chronic condition management, so diabetes and your thyroid issues and like aging population issues. And then they would also have like acute clinics where people would come in with acute problems, so abdominal pains or sore throats, we're not sure what's going on. And you would basically examine the patient, take a history from them, work out what you think the most likely cause is. And then usually what happens is that you'll see five or six patients.
Yeah.
And then there'll be a blocked out time where you'll consult with your GP about the cases you've seen, and you'll go through the cases. And if the GP wants to ask any further questions or any issues, or actually, I think we should do this, then you can obviously bring the patient back up.
Yeah.
And of course, the GP is accessible all the time. So if you're with a patient, actually think, I need some help.
Yeah.
It's an open door policy. You go to your GP supervisor and you say, I've got this patient. This is what I'm thinking, but actually like quite like some advice or some help. And the GP is able to give you advice from there.
And can I just clarify, just maybe for our listeners out there who don't realise that actually not all the time a patient needs to be seen by a GP. A lot of the times when we're in medical school, we also do those similar types of consultations. So we'll sit there, usually for even longer than the PA gets to. It's about 30, 40 minutes. You sit with the patient, you ask them lots of different questions. And actually the opportunity for the patient is that they have a lot of time to spend with you. And actually it is safe because you are able to go back to the GP and tell them what's going on. And secondly, you'd have had read up on all of their notes before you saw the patient. So you'd had a lot more time and a lot more investment in seeing that patient than the GP you potentially might have had. So actually, it's not an unsafe thing to happen. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
And there's been quite a few studies come out, particularly from general practice point of view, not so much from secondary care yet, but that PAs offer the same level of care that a GP would as long as they're working under supervision.
So I want to ask you a few things. Firstly, semantics. Let's clarify. Physician's associate, physician's assistant, and you said something else as well when we were
physician's assistant anesthesia.
Okay, so PAA.
Yeah.
Right.
So
break it down.
So back, obviously, we brought the role over from America, and we were called physician's assistants, and that was the name we were rolling with.
Fine.
And then obviously, as the profession started to expand a bit, and more PAs become more popular. Obviously, we sought statutory regulation under the GMC or the HCPC or someone that can give us some statutory rights.
Yeah.
And as part of that, one of the things that was brought up amongst many was that the fact that the NHS already had a role called physician's assistant.
Oh,
and these were members of staff that didn't have any particular medical training, but they were able to carry out things like bloods, cannulas, ABGs, catheters, and kind of free up the junior doctor's workload from the procedural tasks if they were busy.
Yeah.
And also become very skilled in doing things. If you've got a difficult patient with a difficult catheter that, you know, the nurse or doctor can't get in, they've done them hundreds of times. And so the government was, one of the things they brought up was that there's going to be confusion. If we regulate physician's assistants, no one's going to know, well, is this a person that does catheters or someone that can treat me?
Yeah.
And they wanted a clarification. So the role was moved to physician's associate, which exists in the U states in a couple of programs. So it wasn't a new thing, but it's not widespread. So that's the change of name.
Okay.
Physician's assistants still exists. They're being termed clinical assistants or medical assistants.
Oh, fine.
To try and make them their own identity. And they're very important to the NHS.
So important.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
Important,
And it's just to try and make sure that roles are not confused. And then we obviously have physician's assistants in anesthesia. And these are usually healthcare professionals, but can be biomedical scientists that go into direct training. They do complete a two-year program. It's only in Birmingham, I believe. And then they work under the supervision of a consultant anaesthetist, so that you'll have one anaesthetist and then probably one theatre being run by a PAA and one being run by a trainee. And the idea is that the PAA has been trained in certain procedures, certain ASA grades, they can cover things.
Yeah.
And therefore the consultant can spend time training the trainee anaesthetist, knowing that they've got someone next door that knows the problems and at
and
any
is competent.
Point, and is competent to carry out, you know, to their competence, and knows that if it's without their competence, to immediately seek help.
That's great.
Yeah, that is. And
it's crazy to think that there was so much controversy around the role as well. Because I remember, so this takes me back to my knowledge about PAs and what the role has been from the US to the UK. So I used to do a lot of work with the BMA as part of the Medical Students Committee during my time in medical school, I think towards my final years. Anyway, I remember we received a lot of documents at the time asking us for our consultation and what the role of PA should be within hospitals and whether we had any concerns as medical students and soon to be junior doctors. I remember reading it through it at the time, and I think at face value, when actually a lot of your concerns as a medical student, sorry, as a committee member working for medical students is, are we as medical students getting enough training opportunities? And are we supported well by other junior doctors when we enter those hospitals? And at that time, for various reasons, I feel as though we felt that we weren't getting the best opportunities that we could get. Now, that can be attributed to so many different things, but I think just getting that document at the time, it made us slightly concerned and made us have our ears up. What's that term?
Our hackles. Our hackles were raised.
Our hackles were raised. I've never used that term. And it just made us a little bit concerned that there was this like big group of people who were specialists and postgraduate and coming in and taking all our opportunities away from us. But since working with PAs, I know that is not the case and it's actually very different. So it's funny to be on this side of the conversation now rather than what my initial perceptions were.
Yeah, because I mean, just to touch on that, like absolutely, if imagine as a junior doctor, you've got all these sort of scans to vet or things to do, like little bits and bobs, that if someone else is helping you do those, you actually have more time to sit down with your med student and take them through, okay, what's the best way to manage your ward round? Yeah. Or, okay, they want to see an interesting patient. You can go with them, watch them examine, do their, you know, their like mini kexes and all those little bits. And actually things that you, the only reason you generally don't get to do them is because you're stretched for time. Yeah, and you're like, sorry, you've got to follow me to the radiology department and we can quickly chat as I, you know, get this done. And then, oh, we're going to the lab. And, you know, and it's like in the corridors that you're quickly having hurried chats about things.
It's funny you should say that, because when I was showing one of the new F1s around, the one who's about to become an F1,
Yeah. We
were so busy that day and there was literally no time to teach her. And I felt so bad because I couldn't show her how to do discharge summaries or show her around the ward, introduce her to new people. Mm. But had I had someone there who was just as competent as I am to manage a lot of the problems on the ward, then I would have been able to take her around and show her the job and be able to train her better. So actually, having PAs there is supportive to the role, and I've never, ever seen them detract from the role, genuinely, never.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo that. Like, from our ward, we have two CT trainees and then two F3 equivalent trust grade doctors for 6 months, and we treat them no differently. You know, the CMTs and the trust grades need equal training. So when they just started last week, and like I've known a lot of our patients for the last 12 months.
Of course.
You know, I know them all. I know what problems they've come in with in the past, what weird and wonderful fungal infections they've picked up off a transplant, and why they're on this antibiotic and not that antibiotic. Yeah. And obviously when the new SHOs come in and they're like, oh, you know, should... What's wrong with this person? Why are we giving this drug? I'm like, oh, because I had this, this, and this, and this is the problem we're dealing with now. Mm. And other things like procedure-wise, like before I started, the SHOs wouldn't really get to do like bone marrow procedures. Mm. So when I did bone marrow biopsies, they might see a couple, but they never be able to do one. Mm. And now that I'm competent in doing them with remote supervision, I can get on with one, bring them with me, they can see some with me, and then the next time the reg can take them and they can do one with the registrar supervising.
Super, how good is that?
It's so good. So we've spoken a lot about the benefits for doctors, and I wanted to carry on from what you said about that you've been, you know, you're competent in doing bone marrow biopsies and things now. So what's the progression for a PA? So for someone who's interested in doing physician's associate studies, I mean, obviously you're like selling the dream to us guys, but what about people that want to start it? Because I've got a cousin actually who was asking me about this, and I was like, I'll put you in touch with Jamie.
And it's a big topic. Like a lot of PA students want to know, okay, well, you're qualified and you're completely, yes, you're qualified, but what comes next? And it's a big thing that people are worried about. And it depends on, in my opinion, it depends on the kind of person you are. Mm. So I'm working within hematology. Obviously, I'm not an expert in hematology yet. You know, I can manage the most common malignant issues on the ward, but I'm still learning, you know, general medicine. I have a good general background from our training, but, you know, it comes to a point. And for me, my progression at the moment is learning more about general medicine. So renal, you know, cardio, how do you manage other complex problems within hematology patients?
Yeah,
expanding my examination, you know, diagnostic skills, procedure-wise, you know, bone marrow biopsies for now, and then PICC lines in the future. And then I'm kind of being on the side, like developing some protocols for the juniors when they come in. It's really obvious that if they're on this chemotherapy protocol, on day one, they'll do this. At day five, we expect this to happen to their bloods. This antiemetic needs to be given. So kind of going towards more of a supportive educational role.
Yeah.
And then policy writing alongside other people.
Yeah.
With other seniors. So, you know, I don't think there's like a set career for the future, but there's options and different avenues you can take to kind of build your own pathway, which is another massive thing for PA for me is that there wasn't a defined future. Yeah. I could basically make my own future.
It's clear that you have to be quite self-directed as a PA. It's not as easy as actually going through a training program like us,
yeah.
where you know that you'll go into foundation training, then CMT training, and then become a registrar.
Mm.
Actually, it sounds like a lot more that you have to be self-directed
and you have to pave your
pick
path.
What you're doing.
There's nothing paid for me. Obviously, my consultants have got a plan they would like to get us in malignant heme, do some sickle cell, do some general hematology.
Mm.
But then after that, they're kind of like, well, we'll see how it goes and what your interests lie and, you know, what the service needs.
Yeah.
And that's perfect for me because, you know, I don't want to know that next month I'm just going to be doing this and that's it. It's quite nice to know some flexibility and we're still going to make our plan as we go along.
And with the degree, it's a master's, isn't it? So you have to do an undergraduate degree first and then you do 2 years?
So you have to have undergrad in science or healthcare.
Yeah.
And
can you tell us what other people had and what you have?
So the most common entry route is biomedical science or like a biology chemistry degree. Mm. Then it's allied health professionals, so nurses, radiographers, paramedics.
Mm.
I had a friend on my program that was an ODP that wanted to retrain.
Mm.
They have some people that have had psychology degrees, have had to prove and they've had scientific modules within that, or they've had to do extra modules to prove they've got the scientific capabilities. So you do your undergrad and then you decide you want to be a PA and then you apply to a PA program. And initially, a lot of programs are postgrad diplomas.
Yeah.
They're still 2 years. And my program happened to be a master's, which was 2 years and 3 months. So your 2 years of PG dip training to be a PA,
yeah.
and then you do the extra master's part, which is your dissertation and research project to get the master's.
Okay, fine, fine.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I kind of want to, when you were telling me a lot about physicians associate roles in GP, it was for me just like really making me think of like EMPs and A&E and how similar the job role is. And I know that we've spoken a lot about, say, doctors being worried about how a PA role is going to affect their job. How about people like EMPs?
Yeah.
Are they like trying to fight you guys?
I don't like the word fight. There's some there's some
you EMPs, sit down.
Debating yeah. between lots of professionals. So obviously there's the ANP/ACP route and yeah. there's been lots of discussions between PAs.
Can we just extend these mnemonics, please?
Yeah, yeah. So advanced nurse practitioner is probably the more traditional term everyone's aware of.
Mm.
And then now the rebranding or like the name is becoming advanced clinical practitioner to include allied health professionals. So physiotherapists that want to, you know, become specialists and practice in an advanced role. They're encompassing one unit, so advanced clinical practitioner. And like you said, ANPs, ENPs, emergency nurse practitioners, I like to describe them as specialists in their field.
Yeah.
They know that field inside out. If you've got a cardiology ANP, that ANP will know cardiology inside out, will know all the protocols, how things run, how to manage. You know, if a STEMI comes to the door, they will know from this to diagnosis to management, they will know inside out.
Yeah. And they'll know their department amazingly.
They will know everything inside out. And people also, well, we'll just get more AMPs. What do PAs add compared to them?
Mm.
And for me, is that we're a generalist medical person. We're not a specialist. We don't specialize, unlike the AMPs. We're just general medics that happen to work within a speciality team that will gain speciality knowledge. But every 6 years, we resit all of our general medical exams.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so I saw that actually in my reading. Can I ask, so initially I saw that there's a voluntary register that you guys sign up to.
So
why is it voluntary also?
So the government have been stalling on statutory regulation. PAs have been asking for it for years. There's a consultation just gone through government to ask for the GMC, or the HCPC, which is Health and Care Professionals Council, should take over the management of regulating PAs. It was closed last November. We're still awaiting an outcome.
Okay. What's the general feeling or thoughts?
Most PAs want to go under GMC because we work under a consultant supervision, so there'll be clear lines of accountability from the same regulator, but it's up in the air still.
Would there be an option of going under a different regulator, or would it just be an independent regulator they're looking for as well?
So the government actually want to reduce the number of regulators. So it's probably not going to, we're going to create our own one.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that you're running into roadblocks about it, because I think it's such a, it's like a necessary thing. And I think even from our questions from listeners, the concerns, well, I say concerns, but the query really was, what about regulation? And it's a natural question, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, PAs work under a consultant supervision, consultant or GP. Pretty much no hospital in the country will employ you unless you're on the PA Managed Voluntary Register, which is governed by the Royal College of Physicians. So you have to sit a national exam. It's very set by the RCP. OSCE is written examination. It sets your safety to practice at qualification. And that basically gives you as doctors some alleviating from your concerns that if I do something, it falls to me because I am voluntary registered. The ultimate responsibility falls to the consultant. The same with you guys. If you see a patient make a diagnosis, the consultant is still responsible overall, but you're responsible for your individual actions. And the way that PAs particularly see it is that if I see someone listen to their chest and hear a murmur and I action an event, that's on me because I've said I'm trained to examine a patient. I know what to listen for.
Yeah.
And so that falls to me because I've met the set standards.
Yeah.
Problem is, it's not in law yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's in process.
It's in the, hopefully in the process.
Yeah, fingers
we'll
crossed.
Find out soon.
Yeah, and I think that shows us that we need to start looking at PAs as individuals here, because they all bring a very different background each, and they all contribute to different specialties and different services in their own specific, unique ways. And actually, it sounds like it's the consultants here who are kind of creating the roles for the PAs, looking at what they like skills they offer, and actually. Even the fact that Jamie's able to contribute to guidelines and also create packs for new doctors to come and learn from, that's so important and that's so useful. Yeah. So I can only see it as really improving our service just generally. So we really should start standing behind PAs and working with them to improve the service, because there's so many limitations to what we can do. So it's funny, like when I look at a lot of the F1s who currently work with us, they've always had the experience of having PAs around. Now, our PAs are physician's assistants, not associates. But just the fact that our physician assistants are very well skilled in doing bloods, cannulas, getting our scans organised, speaking to patients for certain things, liaising with the nurses, just getting things done in the hospital, it just frees up so much time.
Yeah.
Like the amount of time that I spent in our first hospital compared to this hospital.
Seriously.
It's so different. And that's just because I didn't have someone to help with my service provision.
Yeah. And then it's things like little things like patients come in with chemotherapy, they're neutropenic or something. Mm. You're busy on the ward. I happen to be seeing the patient with the physician associate. You know that they're able to stabilize that patient pending a doctor review. Which means that you haven't got to worry that, okay, I've got this really sick patient on the ward and someone coming in. I need to be able to see both of them. I don't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after working with me for a few weeks, hopefully you'll trust that, okay, this guy knows how to manage a neutropenic sepsis.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, like, if I was working with you rather than, like, a one-week-old F1, I know that I could just, like, leave you to get on with that neutropenic sepsis, whereas with the new F1, I might just be popping in, seeing what they're doing, because actually a lot of our work is experience and it's knowledge that you gain after working with a certain team.
Yeah.
And there is no way that the new F1s and the new CMTs are going to know more about the specialty than a PA who's been working there for 12 months.
And even practical stuff, like where the heck are the blood culture bottles? Because that is, I feel like sometimes you need like a signposted arrow to find them, because they're always tucked away in some cupboard under the stairs. So with a PA
where
knows.
Where do you find a blood gas machine?
Oh my God,
how do you get
tell
there
me.
And,
yeah.
It took me ages to find them in our last hospital.
The
honestly.
10 layers of security to get into the blood gas room. Yeah. Like, my God. But also, can I play devil's advocate here?
Go ahead.
And say, I completely agree that in our current, you know, well, in our hospital last year where we had physician's assistants, it was
I know what she's going to say.
You know what I'm going to say. It was dreamy to not have to, like, on the ward round, if the nurse is like, oh, the cannula's tissued, and then the, you know, the PA is just like, that's right, I'll do it, and oh, this, yeah, I'll redo the bloods. Oh yeah, can you leave out the blood forms? Yeah, I'll do that. And you're just like, yes, like, do I have any jobs left? Early lunch, Costa. No, not actually. But I was gonna say, I learned my skills of like difficult cannulations and difficult bloods and doing my fem stabs and my layers of escalation and like how to get a blue into this, you know, twiddly little vein on someone's like tip of their thumb. You learn that by grafting on your night shift as an F1,
but
where
you, do,
you
but,
have to.
But Suba, you also learn that on night shifts. Like even in the hospital that we work in currently or just finished working in, they don't have night shifts. So actually, I think we need to start thinking about what experience actually is and where do you get your experience from. I'm not sure if you get a lot of your experience from your normal day job. I think actually it might be the on-call shifts when the hospital itself is quite thin on the ground and you don't have your physician's associates
around.
You
don't have the luxury,
so maybe we need to start looking at making sure there's more... Everyone's going to hate me for this.
Don't even say it, Amelie.
But I can see how useful it is as an F1 to gain experience from night shifts and on-call shifts.
I mean, I'll echo you on that and say, at the end of the day, experience will come when experience comes. And the bottom line is that, I mean, we all know how to do a cannula. And when you are called in the hour of greatest need, whenever that comes for you, whether that's F1, F2, whether that's the CMT, you will eventually have to try and put that blue cannula into the tip of someone's thumb.
Yeah, but what you don't want to do is do 10 in a ward round, because that's just a waste of time, essentially.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting.
So there's that point, batted out of the park.
So we've spoken about the things that you can do and the things that you're allowed to do. So can you just tell us about the things that PAs aren't able to do that clinicians might be able to do?
Yeah, so currently within the regulations of the law, PAs are not able to request ionizing radiation. So that means x-rays and CT scans.
Not even you, JP.
Even me as a previous radiographer, I am not entitled to request x-rays.
Hold on, pause. So you worked as a radiographer for 4 years.
Yeah.
As in, you can read scans,
I
you
know,
can do
the
them
physics,
yourself.
The radiation dose.
Okay, stuff that you know a lot more than we do. You also work in malignant hematology, so you'll need these scans a lot, and I'm sure your consultants will be able to even advise you on what sort of scans. And to be honest, these are things that you know. But are you not even allowed to do it?
No.
Really?
So the current law at IRMA that governs radiation states you have to be statutory regulated. And as I'm working in a role that is not statutory regulated, I'm not entitled to request imaging that involves radiation, ionizing radiation.
Are you allowed to request under the supervision of someone?
Nope.
Oh, really?
So the law says the request has to be submitted by someone who's statutory regulated.
Would a nurse be able to?
A nurse can do it.
Yeah,
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure the EMPs...
Yeah, so nurses are registered by the NMC.
So as long as you're regulated.
Yeah.
So once you guys overcome that hurdle, then...
Then it'll be down to the local radiology departments to decide if they will allow us to do it or not.
Yeah.
And in fairness, like most PAs would never request a CT scan, you know, unless they've discussed it with a reg or a consultant. So actually...
Nor would an F1 or an F2.
I was going to say, like, we're not separate entities. Everyone here is like a logical human being. And you're not going to be... You're not going to be running around like just ordering rogue like MRIs and like...
You get an MRI, you get a CT, yes!
DEXA scan for you. Like, no, you're not going to be doing that. So, but I guess, you know, they've got to go through these processes.
Yeah, and protections,
and it's just
as well.
It's not that I don't know which scans to request or when someone needs a chest X-ray, you know, a PET scan. It's just that the law doesn't enable me to do that. So I can make recommendations part of my plan, but unfortunately it tends to be my SHOs that I speak to and say, could you request a chest X-ray for my patient because I think X, Y, and Z.
And sometimes I think, obviously, these are roadblocks that are being dealt with and over time will evolve. But sometimes that's the frustrating side of things, isn't it? When you formulated a plan, and so the contrasting difference is a doctor. If you formulate a plan, like, you will carry out and you're able to carry out most of the tasks on your job list, whatever. It's frustrating to sort of see a patient and know you need to do this, but then have to go to
someone else
who... Now you're then relying on your relationship with them.
It is very relationship dependent.
Obviously, if you've worked with someone for like 4 months and you know them very well, even 2 months, you've worked with them a lot, you trust them, they come to you and they say, oh, you know, could you put me a chest X-ray? And you're like, yeah. And, you know, they don't even necessarily need to start the spiel of because of X, Y, and Z, because you've gone through that 10 times already in your relationship. whereas, you know, if that's your first time meeting this new doctor on the ward, he's already a bit like, oh my god, where am I, what's going on, and this random guy is coming up to you and being like,
can you request me this CT scan for me?
Can I get a CT head for that patient that fell? And you're like, but why are they on anticoagulation? And you know, so, it's just awkward.
In the first week of when the SHOs rotate, most of my week is spent trying to
convince
them that I am not this rogue person that's going to do scans unnecessarily, and that actually, if I'm saying the scan would probably want to get done, it's because I know the consultant wants it done. So that's the biggest frustration at the moment for me is basic imaging when I know it so well. The other things PAs can't do is prescribe medications, which is obviously vital to any medical role, in that you need to be able to administer medications at the right time. So obviously we were discussing neutropenic sepsis, and you know, you have to be able to give antibiotics, fluids, things like this within a very timely fashion with these patients. And I'm quite lucky in my trust in that we have electronic prescribing. So if I'm on our day unit and someone is florid septic, I can bleep my reg quickly and say, X, Y, and Z, this patient's got this, and the reg, because they've known me for 6 months, will be able to remotely prescribe the stuff so that the nurse staff can initiate treatment.
Yeah.
But it's still a delay. Yeah, there's still that minute of conversation where I've got to get someone to prescribe it for me.
And imagine in a place where you don't have e-prescribing.
Yeah, you've got to run around with your drug chart trying to find someone to prescribe
it. Yeah, it's a pain.
So this is currently why PAs don't work out of hours, because there are reduced staff, and you know, trying to find the F1 or F2 on call that probably has never met you before because they're just covering a shift.
Yeah.
It's probably not the greatest thing right now. So that's why PAs mainly stick to daytime working, because there's a lot of the regular team around that know you and can...
And can I ask you as well, with prescribing, are you guys able to do prescribing courses like nurses are, or not?
Not currently.
Okay, not
so
currently.
Because
why
not,
is that?
So you have to be... Currently the law only allows nurses and some specialists, allied health professionals, so therapeutic radiographers, physiotherapists, podiatrists, they can go on these prescribing courses because the law has been changed to allow them. And recently, paramedics can now go on independent prescribing courses. They can prescribe.
But they're only able to prescribe certain medications.
So they can prescribe anything from the BNF that falls within their competence. Yeah. So, you know, if they're not competent, you know, say, let's say a paramedic has never prescribed warfarin before, you know, it's the first time, then, you know, they all probably seem to seek advice about how they initiate that. But once they're trained and they can do it, there's no reason why they couldn't. Or they can follow a guideline.
Yeah.
Because PAs are not regulated, we're not able to go on the courses yet.
Okay, interesting.
But so this whole regulatory thing is like a real...
It's going to change the landscape. If PAs are not regulated, then I don't know where the profession will be going from there.
But once that's something that's in place, it's going to expand the job role.
Hopefully.
And just make it easier for you guys to do your job and, you know...
Yeah, and support you guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, patients.
Yeah, because I think here we're not even talking about them getting new roles. We're just kind of talking about completion of your jobs. So if you have gone to assess a patient, which a lot of PAs do go and do, you'll be able to complete your jobs and then go back to whoever, just like we as junior doctors do with our seniors.
Yeah.
And I always run my decisions past my reg. It might not be at the same time. I might see a patient on the ward round, do everything for them, and then go back to my reg, and usually at lunch we'll go through the patients and go, I've done X, Y, and Z, this, what's wrong with them? And the reg will then either go, oh, I think we should do this as well, have you thought about this? Or yeah, no, I complete with your plan, I'll prescribe that for you.
And I can totally see where the concern lies, because like, even with our like roguer F1s, they have all these powers and they're able to do all of these things. So it is a bit concern. It feels concerning to allow a group that we don't even understand their training to say, yes, you can prescribe, yes, you can book scans, because it does feel like, oh, they're kind of creeping up on our job. But I did read this article actually, and it was interesting. It was about a junior doctor who'd worked with a surgical PA for quite some time. And she was talking about how the surgical PA went to go and assess a patient and did a whole full examination and history and had recommendations and a plan in place. But that PA wasn't able to prescribe medications, so called and asked, can I prescribe medications? And obviously, her as an independent clinician, she doesn't want to just go and prescribe something just because someone's told her to. And she said, yes, I really trusted my PA and we'd worked together for so much time. So actually, he did know a lot more than I did. But I always felt that I had to go read through his notes, do the examination over again and do exactly the same thing that he was going to basically put in place all his recommendations as well. So she was talking about the duplication of time that was just essentially time wasted just because she had to go and re-examine the patient herself to do exactly what he was going to do.
And I think that boils down to, like, you know, when we were talking about other prescribing healthcare professionals, it's obviously fine because at the end of the day, when you put your signature, it's your...
You're prescribing.
It's on your it's on your sort of like professional recommendation. It's on you. And obviously the difficulty is that if someone comes to you and says, can you prescribe this? At the end of the day, if something, you know, was to go wrong,
It's on the prescribing doctor.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's why a lot of people have a lot of sort of like, there's a bit of trepidation around just doing it. And like we said,
and
a lot
I feel
of it,
the pressure.
And a lot of it relies on your relationship and your trust. And also there's a degree of everyone's own intrinsic level of like how, maybe nervous isn't the right word, but maybe like conscientious, I don't know.
I mean, concern. People are, you know, if you're prescribing a medication, you've never seen that patient.
Yeah.
You could be like, okay, well, you know, okay, you want to give them Busoprolol, but have you checked X, Y, and Z to make sure they don't, so they can have the drug.
Yeah.
And as a PA, whenever I approach my SHOs, I'm like, could you prescribe this? I probably triple check the BNF, the EMC, the drug, you know, to make sure, because I'm trusting that the SHO, to trust me, and if I make a mistake, that trust is gone, and I don't want that F1, you know, that junior.
But that's also you as a good clinic, like independent clinician, Jamie. That's might not be everyone.
Not everyone.
I think that's what people's concerns are.
Yeah, and I mean, but all of that's going to be on a case by case basis, because you know the person you work with, and you develop that relationship. And until you develop that relationship, you are going to have a degree of like double checking and triple checking, and you know,
he knows
blah, blah, blah.
But he maybe doesn't know that so well from previous.
Let me just check that, or you know, whatever else.
Oh, and my friend actually, who was responding to the post that I shared from you on my Instagram, she asked quite a couple of questions. Let me ask the first one: how do you introduce yourself to patients, and how do you explain who you are, and do they trust you?
So, see, in hematology, these are long-term patients, so they need to know from day one who I am and what I do. So whenever I go to meet a patient, I start off, you know, hey, my name's Jamie, welcome, you know, I'm one of the inpatient hematology team. I think it's important they recognize that I'm part of their team. Mm-hmm. I'm not just this rogue person. And then I obviously, how are you, whatever. And then I say to them, before we start, let's just clarify, I'm not a doctor. And that's the first thing I say to them. Mm-hmm. And they kind of look at me and I go, I'm a physician associate. Have you ever heard this term before? Yeah. Do you know what this means? And usually the answer is no. And then I go through, okay, I'm a physician associate. I'm not a doctor. I've worked with the doctors. I generally work with the junior doctor team. I can see you. I can examine you. I can make a management plan, but I work under the supervision of a consultant. Mm-hmm. I'm not independent. What this means is that my decisions are always go through a doctor before I can action anything at the moment. Mm-hmm. In the future, when I gain more knowledge and skills, some basic level things such as bloods, I won't have to ask for. But at the moment, I run it past the consultant. Do you have any further questions about my job?
And they're like, no, thank you so much.
And they look at me really, and they're like, I know everything now. But, the faculty,
it's so important to tell people just what's going on, isn't it? But we can learn from that as well.
So next question.
Yeah.
Are PAs considered cheap labour? Because obviously they perform a similar role to doctors, but maybe paid less, or unless you're about to correct us on that, Jamie.
I think the answer is in some trusts and by some medical directors, yes, they see us as a cheaper alternative to doctors. Mm. And there have been reports, and you know, I've seen it with my own, you know, from hearing from other people, that trusts have replaced SHOs or that with PAs.
Mm-hmm.
And the faculty PAs, the Royal College Physicians, do not advocate this. Most PAs, I would say 99%, would not want to work for in an SHO's position, because we're not SHOs. We are an addition to the team. We supplement the team. We should not be replacing anybody. If you need an SHO, employ an SHO. Don't employ a PA.
Mm-hmm.
You need to want a PA to add and benefit your patients and your SHOs. And we're not cheaper. We are, you know, you guys have your medical contracts. We have an agenda for change. Mm-hmm. We are band 7. That's quite a senior position. Mm-hmm. There's only 9 bandings.
Yeah.
We're at band 7. We're not a cheaper alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and that also brings up other issues that like people, doctors say, well, you're paid more than me, but you do less than me. So there's swings and roundabouts from both sides.
Yeah.
But we're definitely not cheaper doctors, because we're not doctors. It's just, I can't put it any other way.
So the next question is, we've touched on this slightly. So you're not governed under a governing body. So who are you accountable to?
So as a member of the Physician Associate Managed Voluntary Register, I'm accountable to myself. Obviously, if you're on the street and you stick a needle in someone, you're also responsible for what you're doing on the street, whether you're in a hospital or not.
Yeah, but legally as well.
Legally, and within a hospital, obviously, I'm responsible for the actions I carry out. But ultimately, I work currently under my consultant supervision. And my consultant tells me or sets my scope of practice of what I can and can't do.
So,
but if I had asked you, say that I've come to you and I said, I've got a patient with vomiting and I would like to give them some ondansetron, please.
Mm-hmm.
I've advised you for that advice. If you go ahead and prescribe it, I've asked you for that advice. That's on you for, because I've
And that's no different
that.
To a nurse coming to you and saying that thing. And actually, it's very interesting. When I look at your curriculum for physician associate studies, actually, it's very similar to the medical curriculum. And what we're both trained to do, I think, are to be diagnosticians. Whereas with nurses, they're meant to care for patients and follow up and carry out procedures. So we actually do have very similar mindsets as physicians and physicians associates. So I think we need to really understand the training and understand the program before we start to criticize or start to even see how we can further improve it.
Because, you know, if a clinical nurse specialist from palliative care came to you and said, can you prescribe a syringe driver? You probably wouldn't think twice about it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people are like, well, this PA has asked me to prescribe Comox. Why do you think he can do that? But, you know, it's just because...
I will prescribe it if I want to.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so it's just, I think it's just learning our role and what we can, you know, what our capabilities are.
So thanks, Jamie. It's been really interesting to learn about the physician's associate role and from, like, you know, like in a clear way. Obviously, you know what you're talking about, and hopefully it's been helpful for our listeners as well, who had all the questions about things. So
yeah, and I think we've definitely cleared up some of the misconceptions and the perceptions of what PAs do and what their role looks like. I think clearly there needs to be some sort of shift and some sort of change in the service provision in the NHS, whether that's for us looking at our role as doctors and how our job can be improved, but also how we can start to support the roles of other people within our trust. So whether that is the nurses and advanced nurse practitioners, or whether that is PAs being either physician assistants or physician associates, we all have different roles and we just need to see how we can better help and improve the service
and bridge the gaps. And I think that's a beautiful thing that physicians associates and physicians assistants as well, shout out to them, that they do, is that they bridge the gaps between different specialties and kind of like fill in the grooves.
And we've not even touched about the actual rota gaps that they fill, but we've lots of studies show that they've improved the rota gaps for lots of trusts and lots of hospitals. Lots of studies also show that they improve the amount of time clinicians get to spend with their patients and dealing with things that they want to spend time on. And as we even said in our experience, the amount of time you spend in hospital can drastically reduce just because you've got an assistant there to get rid of a lot of the jobs that you would have to otherwise be doing. So for me, it's really a win-win situation.
Yeah,
I understand it's controversial, but I'm not entirely sure why it's this controversial.
Agreed. I think it's also a win-win situation. And I just think that the only roadblocks that we've already spoken about is the whole regulation thing that's kind of proving to be like a real...
And I think once that comes, it'll be much more clearer lines of accountability. And doctors don't have that worry about who is taking responsibility.
Exactly.
Because, you know, it's still up in the air. I can say this is how it is, but other people will have completely different opinions. And... you know, it just needs, regulation needs to come. So please lobby.
And you want the regulators.
We want it. We want to be regulated. You know,
because it will expand your job role. And, you know, you feel more confident and comfortable in your role. I mean, we say that now. And then once you have the PMC, we'll be like...
like, oh, God.
What do they do?
So just to finish, Jamie, can I ask, what are your future plans and where do you see your job going or your life going, just generally speaking? If you've got any interests outside of... work and where you see everything.
So I'm still really interested in German. And so
I knew you were going to talk about German.
Has to come up somewhere. So in November I'm starting my German course at King's again, not as a like a degree, but just as a language course.
Yay!
Because Germany has recently adopted the PA role, and I would quite like in the future to be involved with how they develop the role out there. So if I can speak medical German, you know, maybe I could go out there for a year or two, get the role going, and show them what the UK has been up to. In the same way that the Netherlands. It's really taken off in the Netherlands. So I'd quite like to get into Germany, Austria, Switzerland. One of my messages just told me they've got surgical PAs out there now.
Okay.
So I hope I can get into that.
International.
Oh, I'm so happy you asked that question.
It's amazing.
So thank you so much for joining us, Jamie. And thanks for our listeners for listening. As always, guys, please listen, please share, please subscribe to our podcast. Also, we have joined Twitter, finally.
We have.
So find us at After the Letters and see you guys later.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Yeah, thanks guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Today's episode was recorded at Mare Street Market.
Catch us over on www.afterthelettersmarket.com or /afterthelettersmarket on every social media network.
Thank you. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.